Welcome to the Muscle Expert Podcast with Ben Pakulski, one of the world's top professional bodybuilders, an expert on human performance and mindset mastery. Ben dives deep to deliver the strategies of the top experts to upgrade your body, mind, muscle, strength, performance, biochemistry, and how to become the upgraded modern man. Join us on BenPakulski.com to learn the cutting-edge techniques to take control of your body, your brain, and create your greatest life.
Hey, what's up, ladies and gents? Ben Pakulski, Muscle Expert Podcast. Today, we have perhaps the most extreme athlete on the entire planet. This guy has done something that nobody else has ever done, and probably nobody else will ever be quite crazy enough to ever do or ever attempt. Talk about feats of strength or endurance. Talk about feats of mental fortitude. I don't think there'd be very few things that compare ever in the history of man, or at least in the recorded history of man, and he may be able to tell me otherwise because I'm sure he's done some research into it. But James Lawrence has done 50 triathlons in 50 days in 50 different states. And that is absolutely ridiculous and commendable, James.
Yeah, thank you. And just a point of clarification. So a triathlon is swim, bike, run.
Yep.
And I did the longest of the standard family, which would be the iron distance, which is a 2.4 mile swim, 112 mile bike, and a 26.2 run, which is the standard distance of a marathon.
Full marathon, which is every single day for 50 days. So I just, as I told you before we got on the call, I just finished reading your book, where James goes into every detail about this entire journey. From even before he decided to do it, why he decided to do it, and then the entire unfolding of the event, which is absolutely an essential read for anybody out there who loves to hear about why an athlete does what they does and what makes them tick. So, man,
what we can do is if we want to set up a discount code for your listeners, what do you want to use for the word, and we'll get anybody a discount that wants to get a hold of the book.
We can do BPAK, B-P-A-K.
Okay, be back it is, and we'll give you guys a discount. Anybody that wants to order it, and you can get it on ironcowboy.com.
Yeah, man, that's where I picked mine up, and the coolest thing was it came signed, so not that I'm holding you to that. All of my listeners are going to expect you to sign the copies. Do you sign everyone's copy, man?
So we have a limited run right now of hardcover, and yep. we are signing those. We're almost out of those, and as soon as those are out, we're going to go to a soft cover that won't be signed.
So get them quick, ladies and gentlemen. Get them while they're hot. You know, you're a good Canadian boy, and I always love to talk to good Canadian boys. But for those that haven't read the book or who don't know about your journey, it's a really, really fascinating journey. Can we talk about what happened before? Yeah, what were you doing before this 50-50-50 and, you know, how you led down that path of why you wanted to do this?
Yeah, I grew up in Canada, and it's cold. And it's interesting because you look back on it and you're like, why do people live there? And the reality is that we just don't know better and we don't have any other options. And so we just do it. But like you, I went kind of sun seeking and found a good American girl and landed myself in Utah, which I absolutely love it here. And I found myself, you know, a couple small kids married and needing to provide a living for them. I got into the mortgage industry because it was booming down here. And in 2008, when the economy just hit rock bottom, it impacted my industry the hardest. It impacted everybody, but it was a direct hit to what I was doing. Yep. And we lost everything, like a lot of Americans and even Canadians for that point. I mean, Canada's going through a rough time right now. But we did. We lost everything, and it was actually a blessing in disguise because it gave me the opportunity to hit the reset button and kind of go after a dream and a passion of doing something different that was for me, and we could involve it with charities and just kind of rebranded ourselves and went after something that was kind of unimaginable.
And one of the coolest stories you had in your book was the Ferris wheel story, and I love for you to share that because that really gives an insight into your mentality and why you succeeded at this.
Well, you know, looking back at anybody's life or journey that is on a journey that is taking risks and some chances, you know, you look back and there's turning points or pivotal moments in your life, and the Ferris wheel was a massive turning point for me. And I kind of talk about, because I speak from stage, and I like to talk about not being so rigid with your plan, and kind of just going with the flow of things, mm-hmm. kind of knowing the destination you want to go, but being a little bit open on how the path is that you're going to get there. And for me, an opportunity came in Calgary, where the Calgary Stampede, one of the biggest rodeo stops in the world, was putting on, you know, they do a 10-day huge party every single year. And radio contest was putting on a contest to see who could ride the Ferris wheel for the full 10 days of the rodeo, and they were giving away $10,000. And so to me, that was a definite risk, and something that I thought I could do mentally, and jumped on the ride and ended up winning the competition, and ultimately hitchhiked a ride to Utah. I had one buddy that lived here, and it completely altered, you know, my life. Who knows what I would be doing now? I'd still be chasing big dreams, but who knows in what avenue. But it completely changed, because I ended up in Utah to visit my friend, and never went home, and ended up meeting my wife, staying here, and then together we've had a journey of fitness that I could have never anticipated.
You did a really good job in the book of breaking it down and literally walking through the mental aspect of just that 10-day Ferris wheel ride and all the, you know, the mental games that you played with yourself to make yourself stay on, and that literally was the perfect segue into why you found triathlons. And let's talk about that, man, because you said at that point you weren't doing any type of endurance racing or any endurance work.
No, I didn't have a swim, bike, or run background, and it was just, you know, I grew up in Canada as a wrestler, and you know, you either play hockey or basketball, and if you're too short, you wrestle. And so I did that, and I just fell in love with it, and just really had a passion for that. But then once you get married, you don't have an avenue to wrestle anymore. And MMA wasn't big at the time, and so I got into the running and the swimming and the biking with my wife. But it was a real humble beginning. I mean, I started. People that hear my story now, they're like, oh, you've always had this background. But I started getting up off the couch and struggled my way through a 4-mile fun run, you know. And so I think that's why my story is somewhat relatable for a lot of people once they really get into it and start diving into it, is I'm just like everybody out there that is starting from the first step and not knowing if they're capable of, you know, running the simplest of things, which is just a simple 5K run.
And amazing. So, you know, your journey from what you say is not being able to at least easily run a 4-mile run to deciding to attempt an iron distance triathlon. Can we talk about how that happened? Because you tell it in the story in the book, and that's a really great story. I don't want to just kind of glance over that, because you just literally did one and then decided, hey, I'm going to do this really cool thing. So I want to hear your side of it.
Yeah, I started running, and I actually didn't enjoy running. It really sucked, and so a lot of people find that, but it was kind of a segue to get me to do sprint distance triathlons, which is the shortest distance, and that was a lot of fun for me. It was a lot of explosiveness. I was learning how to, you know, a new skill of being on a bike, and I was learning you know, how to swim. And so I really liked the aspect of there being swim, bike, and run, three different sports to kind of master. And I really gravitated towards cycling and just the triathlon and the short explosiveness of it. I really did that for quite a few years, just really developing that skill and learning the sport. It's got a heavy learning curve, in my opinion, especially once you get into the longer distances. There's so many different elements to it. You know, your sprint distance racing is going to be very different than your strategy, your technique, and your training for an iron distance. And so I really took my time and evolved through the distances. And then just all of a sudden in 2008, I felt like I was ready, and I did an iron distance race in California, and just loved it. I loved the challenge of it. I loved the endurance. It had a strength component to it. You really had to dig deep mentally. There were so many components that made it difficult and rewarding once you did it. And then it's kind of addicting. You do something like that and you look back at your day and you're like, ooh, I could have been, you know, a couple minutes faster here, a couple minutes faster there. And then, you know, once I got competitive at all of the distances, then I was like, you know what, I wonder what I can do to raise money for charity, because it was after we lost everything in 2008. And then I just started racing to raise money for charity with half Ironmans, and completely by accident broke the world record for the most half Ironmans done in a year. And then I was just sitting there with my wife and I was like, I don't really want to be the half Ironman world record holder. I wonder what the record for full Ironmans is. And then ended up, you know, going after that and intentionally trying to break that record, and we did. And then really,
what's that record, James?
It was 30 Ironmans, 30 official events in 11 countries. And we did that in 2012. And just at the end of that, just, you know, I always want to push the envelope as far as mental and physical limits is, just me personally. And kind of once I finished the 30, I looked back and I'd won two events, placed second five times, and my body just really adapted to doing an Ironman every single weekend in these events, and I just knew that wasn't where my journey ended, and you know, there's a guy in the running industry, his name's Dean Karnazes, and he's had an incredible journey in endurance racing, and his story is really, really cool as well. But he kind of made a career for himself, and he did 50 marathons in 50 days in 50 states. And so I thought, man, wouldn't it be cool if I could pull off an Ironman every single day in 50 states? I wonder what that would do for kind of a career and making this a brand and raising money for a charity. And I was like, yeah, we've got to do that. And for me, I mean, obviously it's completely nuts and batshit crazy. But looking at where I was, it was the next natural step or progression in what I was doing. Now looking back on it, we were completely nuts.
Right.
You're like, yep, you are.
Yeah.
But I think being a little bit naive and having just an incredible passion and desire for something, you can achieve just these unbelievable things. I think just a little bit of naivety and the unknown is somewhat of a blessing in disguise, because it almost gives you this cloak of invincibility. I think a lot of times when you I think not knowing is a blessing, because I think had we known what it was going to take, I don't know that we would have done it.
I completely agree, man. Ignorance is amazing, and I think in reality we pigeonhole ourselves into these limitations that we build around ourselves. And I've recently talked to a bunch of Navy SEALs about the 20 times principle, and they say you're capable of 20 times what you think you are, not 20%, 20 times. But we just believe that, hey, this is what our kind of limiting beliefs place on us. And man, you're a perfect example of someone who said, went ridiculously beyond what any human being would think they're capable of. Because to be honest, like, you know, I would have assumed after 10 to 12 days, shit would have just started to break. And just kind of testament for what the body's really capable of if, the mind is strong enough.
Yeah, and that's what it was amazing, because shit did start to break.
Yeah,
you know, day five we started to break down and experience things, but that's what's amazing is that's when people quit, because the mind and the body weren't in alignment at that point. And it takes a lot of time. When things get real, that's when people quit, right? Mm-hmm. But it's beyond that. Oh man, things are really real, and if you stick to it, your body evolves and adapts, and your brain gets stronger, and it adjusts to everything that's going on around it. And so it was really, really cool for us to you know, to see all of those changes take place, because, you know, we obviously bit off way more than we could chew, and there was a ton of social media pressure, there was a ton of sponsorship pressure, and so we, you know, the panic button was always there. But when you go into something like this, you have to believe that the panic button doesn't exist. And I think that's the true sign or symbol of someone who really is going to go find their mental and physical limits, is when that to me is true mental strength. When the panic button is sitting right in front of you, but you can't see it. It doesn't even exist. Right. It's like, I'll never compare myself to a war situation or prisoners of war, because they didn't have a panic or escape button. They had to survive.
Yeah.
And I think we, you know, those guys truly defy logic and what the mind and body is capable of. But when that panic button is in front of you and you have an out, that's when I really think you grow as a person, because you chose not to push the button. You chose not to take the easy way out. You chose not to give yourself the excuse. And so I love when people self put them through some type of challenge and there is an out, and then they don't take it.
Beautiful, man. So you talk around that 5-day mark where, you know, things started to break and you had this panic button in front of you, or at least it was there, and you decided not to take it, man. And this is the kind of stuff my listeners are going to love is, you know, truth be told, we don't have a lot of triathletes, listeners of my podcast, at least that I know of, although I'm starting to train for one now, which is a different topic. But I think it'd be very interesting to hear, like, what was going on in your mind, man? Because, like, you know, every day we face these challenges, whether it be just a day-to-day workout or whether it be the day-to-day bike ride that you do or a day-to-day run. And every day there's these challenges that go, man, I just don't feel it today. I feel like shit. I want to go home. And everybody goes through that. What's the breaking point for you, man? Why does it not exist?
Yeah, and it's 100% a choice, because it's a choice and a decision, and everybody, we're all human, and we all have these experiences where we don't feel good or we don't want to, and it's just a matter of deciding to go all in. And once you truly make the decision to go all in, then it's a matter of forming enough belief and conviction to push through it. You've heard people say, you know, what's your why? What's your reason for doing something, right?
Yep.
And your why is very important. But I think there's a huge component of that that's missing. And for me, I want people to understand that you have to pick a goal that scares you. And for me, it was to the point that it scared me, but I was naive enough to make it, and then I was ridiculed for it and made fun of. And so I knew, okay, this must be real, because I'm being attacked for having a goal like this. And then
so you're ridiculed for the 50-50-50?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, just because it was so above what had already been accomplished, people couldn't wrap their minds around it.
So they were saying, what, you're trying to be sensationalist, or what was their argument?
No, just that it's impossible, that it's not achievable, that I'm going to die. I mean, physicians straight up told me that we were going to die to attempt it. Logistically, it's not possible. Physically, it's not possible. All of these things that we weren't going to be able to control. And I forget the original question, but really that's why we had no support when we were doing this, because nobody wanted to associate themselves with a failure, because it was so impossible. So we got very little support going into this, and even the support that we got from sponsors, they were like, yeah, we're going to put our name on it, but we don't think you'll do all 50, but you'll get far enough that we'll associate. I mean, I literally had sponsors that backed me that said, we don't think you can do it, but you'll get far enough.
Well, so the question was, how did you overcome that original, inevitability that everyone quits at some point? Is it just, you just blocked it out of your mind? You said, no matter what happens, I'm going to do this? Because even in your book, you talk about times where, like, you're just like, F this, man. Like, you know, you're falling asleep on your bike, literally in the middle of a ride, and you crash and you hurt yourself, and you get up and you keep going. It's such an interesting topic of discussion to say, like, what's taking your brain to that point where you're able to switch it off? Is it the fact that every time you get to that point, you overcome it and you overcome it and you overcome it? You've almost developed like a callus or willpower to say, no, I won't stop.
Yeah, and you know, it's one of the biggest questions I got is how do I get mentally tougher? How do I get to the point where I can turn that off? And I don't know how to turn it off. I almost have to be in that situation in order for it to happen. But the reality is it's like a muscle. It's like going to the gym. It's like your cardiovascular, your muscular structure, and then you have your mental capacity. And you can't just wake up one morning and be mentally tough. And for me, it started way back in, you know, early days when I started wrestling. I mean, I got my ass handed to me. And every time I'd get back up and I'd figure out how to overcome that. And every time I'd lose, I'd get stronger mentally. And then, you know, fast forward to the Ferris wheel, learning how to control my mind for 10 days on the Ferris wheel. And then learning how to get through the first world record and then the second world record. And then all of those things led me to the point where I could even conceptualize and start to take on the 50 Ironmans. And I think that's why we were ridiculed so bad, is because from where I was literally sitting, it was logical. Because of everything and past experiences, but the guy that I was, and the guy that was looking at it, that was, had either done one Ironman or was sitting on the couch and can't run the 4 miler like I couldn't,
right.
He's going, no possible way. And so,
right.
and that's what's beautiful about life, is its perception, right? So perception and where you're sitting is very important to any conversation, because for me, it was reality, it was real, it was the next step. But for somebody else, their perception on it is totally skewed because of where their personal journey is. Perception has everything to do with an individual's journey and where they're sitting.
Absolutely. Man, fascinating. So I just pulled up your website, and I'm looking at, you've got some really great data, and, you know, even things like your mental state and your physical energy, all tracked in your website. So I'm definitely compel people to get over there and check this out. But I want to walk through, you know, your high points and your low points, particularly your low points on this journey, man, because, you know, some of these triathlons are substantially longer. And I know you talk about having to, I don't want to give away the things you overcame along the way. I want you to talk about it. But I know you had to overcome some absolutely ridiculous injuries and some ridiculous circumstance. So talk a little bit about, you know, some of the hardest times in this 50 days, man, because I'm flipping through your site, and I've got some Ironmans that are, you know, 17 hours. I got some that are 12 hours. 17 hours of work, and you sleep 4 hours, 5 hours, you get up the next day and do it again. Where's your head?
Yeah. We touched on it earlier about when the mind and the body come into alignment, and that's when things become bliss. And, you know, for us and as a team, the support crew and me as an athlete doing it, that didn't happen until Ironman 30, day 30.
Wow.
And I can't imagine many people, you know,
going
2 mile 30 to get to the point where an Ironman is now routine and you figured it out. I mean, every single day we were dealing with different struggles and obstacles. I mean, that's what made it so special and kind of the perfect storm is we became master problem solvers and we figured out how to do that. But I mean, on day five, you know, I tear my shoulder. I've got, you know, 45 more Ironmans to do, and I've got to figure out how to swim a 2.4 mile swim with one arm and adapt to that. You know, a very difficult stretch was 17, 18, 19, and even a little bit before that, we were chasing a Hurricane Bill, which caused a ton of problems for us. I lost all the toenails on one foot, and the nerve endings were exposed, making it extremely painful to run. I talk about it in the book, and I describe it as every step was like a nail gun was being shot through my foot. You know, and then day 18, you know, averaging 4 hours of sleep a night, you just have no chance to recoup. And day 18, you know, I fell asleep on the bike. You lose concentration for 3 seconds and you fall asleep and you crash. And now you're dealing with that trauma. And, you know, it's in those moments where it's like, okay, I have to make a decision. I've got 80 more miles to go on day 18. Do I get back up on my bike, or is 17 consecutive Ironmans good enough? And it always came down to, I said I was going to do 50. Oh, I remember the tail end of that question. We were talking about your whys.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about how when your goal is so big that you get made fun of, then you know you're in the right space. But if your goal is big enough and the journey is challenging enough, you should be scared. But one why is never going to be enough. And a lot of people talk about find your why, find your why, find your why. You got to find 20 whys. And
when you're doing 50 Ironmans.
Yeah, well, anything that's big enough that scares you, you need to have 20 whys, because one isn't enough. Because, you know, when I fall off my bike on day 18 and my hip is instantly swollen and my feet are killing me and I'm exhausted and I'm averaging 4 hours, sleep a night and 10 to 12,000 calories a day and I'm struggling to function and you pull out your one why, no, that's never right. it's never gonna be enough. Right. And so you gotta reach in and pull out a second one, a third one, a fourth one, and I believe if you have 20, you're well armed enough to take on any goal. But if you have a big enough of a goal and you only have one why, you need to hit pause, and you need to sit down and do some self reflection and really start to pull out all the reasons, because when it gets real, you're going to need to put more than one of those suckers together in order to get back on your bike. Bike 80 more miles that day, slam yourself in the back of a Subaru, drive to Mississippi, and get up the next day and do it again.
Now you just say that like it's no big deal. At that point, you're looking at like, okay, I've done 17. I'm doing pretty good, but I have 32 more of these things to go. What is in your head and how? What are your whys at that point, right? Is it your family? Is it your integrity? Is it you're just like, F this, everyone says that I can't do it, so I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it with a big smile on my face, or...
Yeah, it's all of that. It's your family, it's the sponsors, it's the haters online, and they came out in droves, and it's the grit your teeth and pound your chest, F you, I can do this. And really, learning all of those lessons and what motivates me and what did it, and then it all came to a head on Ironman 30 in Connecticut, where I was just like, I've really gotta shift the energy and my attitude and why I'm doing this and who I'm doing this for. And as soon as I had that mind shift to change it from I'm gonna prove you mother effers wrong to, you know what, I'm gonna prove me right, I'm gonna prove to me that I can do this. And everything shifted as soon as I made that choice and decision. I talk about 10% of life is what happens to us, and 90% is how we choose to react to it. And it was in that moment, I'm laying on the side of the road, like literally in the fetal position in Connecticut, and I'm like, I can't do this. I cannot do this anymore. And I'm like, you know what? Yeah, I can. I can concentrate on the next step. I can be so very present. I don't have 20 more to go. I have the next step to take. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I became so hyper-focused, I knew, and now I call it the power minute, I knew that I could be perfect for 60 seconds at any given time. And for me to be perfect for 60 seconds was achievable. And even once I got, so I've got 20 to go, right? And my brain couldn't process 20 more Ironmans at that point. It was just, it was mentally overwhelming and it would shut me down. But I could handle anything in single digits. And so when I had like 18 to go, it was, I had nine to go to nine to go, nine more to nine to go, yep. Eight more to nine to go. And then it would be, I would start playing with numbers. And then once we got 11, I'd be like, two more to nine to go. And then we started on the countdown, because mentally I could process single digits. And to get to single digits, I could process the next step or the next stroke. And I had to be very, the crew had to shut me off from everything that was distracting. And I had to focus on just taking the next step. And what's amazing, and it's totally mind-blowing the way the mind and the body works once you put all of the right keys to it, my times over the last 20 of the 50 were faster than the 30 before it.
Right.
And so not only did we achieve it, we increased the physical performance once the mind and the body align themselves. But 99.9% of people would have quit before Ironman 30, before they experienced bliss to where an Ironman was routine. And on my last Ironman, I did an 11:32 Ironman, and we dipped below 6 minute miles for the last 5K. It was just crazy.
Man, I love that you say this, because you're so into the fitness industry as well, just like I am. And you see all these people out there claiming to be working hard, and the reason I'm so excited to have you is this is just a massive paradigm shift for people, to make them realize that what you're doing, what they're doing on a day-to-day basis, is so insignificant to what they're capable of. And this is the biggest eye-opener, and why this is such an important conversation for you to spread with the world, to share with the world, is when your mind says it's hard, like you say, your perception has to shift. And I always say, when things get hard, when you're at the deepest depths of suck, smile, because that's when you're becoming a better man. And I think that, man, you're the perfect poster boy for, the upgraded man.
Well, I keep getting taught the same lesson, and I believe we go through life and we all have to learn the same lessons. And until we learn the lesson, we're going to keep getting put in opportunities or where we get to learn that lesson. But you know, even after the 50, this year I had an awesome year where I got to take my mountain bike to Mount Kilimanjaro and climb to the top of 20,000 feet on my bike. And then I ran 235 miles across Greece. And then I did four of the extreme Ironmans across the globe. But when I was on Mount Kilimanjaro, climbing the mountain on my bike, I was, you know, it was so hard and challenging. Every boulder pissed me off. And I just couldn't get a clear path. And I was only going 10 feet at a time. And I was getting short on oxygen. And I was just grumbling, man. And then we were at the base camp at 12,500 feet. And this group had come down from summiting the day before. And there was a girl in it. And she had one leg. And I was like, holy shit. I am pissing and moaning about a little bit of oxygen, and chick doesn't even have a leg, and I'm like, I need to shift my mindset right now. And then she was with another dude, and he's blind as a, like, he's blinder than blind.
Wow.
And like, can't see anything. And I got to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, and I have an incredible view. And in the same view shot, I can see the sun rising and the moon setting. And I'm just like, holy cow, these are the types of things I get to experience. And it goes back to 10% of life is what happens to us. 90% is how we choose to react to it. And I had a massive mind shift again on the mountain. And I was like, I get to experience this mountain right now, and I can choose to be pissed off and grumble about that boulder, or I can absorb all of the energy and completely, and you know, take in this unbelievable experience. And I'm so grateful that I ran across those people, you know, and that had those unfortunate things happen to them, but they were living life. And I loved that I was able to have that mind shift, and I had a completely different experience after that. And I celebrated every 10 feet that we made, and I embraced the mountain. We started singing with the African people, and it was just an amazing experience to climb Kilimanjaro on a mountain bike. And it was just, it was a shift of an attitude. And it no longer became a grind. It became a celebration and an adventure.
Dude, I absolutely love that, man. That's absolute perfect. Absolutely perfect. Just to make people realize, man, smile. Like, you're on Mount Kilimanjaro. You're doing one of the coolest things. Most people will never get the opportunity to do that, nor will they even be capable physically and mentally. Man, that's such a great lesson for people out there to hear. I want to, you know, get back to this 50-50-50, and then I want to come back to Kilimanjaro, because I know my demographics would be very interested to hear, how the heck did you nourish yourself? Because without a shadow of a doubt, you need 10,000-plus calories a day. How are you nourishing yourself while effectively competing in a triathlon for 12 to 17 hours every single day? Because did you stop to eat? Did you eat on the bike or when you're running? Or what did it look like?
Yeah, we couldn't stop moving, and so I was always consuming. We were always up against the clock because we had to get to the next state, mm-hmm. you know. And the longer I braked, I mean, and the crew was very good at trying to keep me moving, because at that point I'm trying to find every excuse to stop moving. And also, if I stopped moving, I'd fall asleep. But yeah, consuming, you know, and we were caught between a rock and a hard place, because we did this journey. We partnered with the Jamie Oliver Foundation, and we did this journey to raise money for childhood obesity. And one of our main focuses was clean eating and real food and all of that. And so it would have been insanely hypocritical to go out and just pound, you know, insane amounts of garbage to fuel my way through this. And so we did the best job we could, and consumed a lot of clean food. But I mean, that means eating a ton of food. But we did a ton of potatoes, a lot of eggs, a lot of avocados, a lot of nuts, a lot of high fat foods. And like I said, we were doing it 10 to 12,000 calories a day. But my engine was burning so hot that I could consume anything. I mean, I got down to 4% body fat, but I maintained my weight. And so I just had a composition change in my body. But, you know, this is something that the general masses, I try to convey if it comes up. And this is the only time I encourage people to try to achieve mediocrity or a B-plus average. And what I mean by that is, I'm sick and tired of people crash dieting and then turning themselves into a dumpster fire. Because what they do is they get motivated somehow, whether they hear something or do something or something sparks and they want to make a change, and they go online and they just pick the most ridiculous, challenging diet to do, and they nail it for 20, maybe 30 days, but then they make a mistake and they just turn into a train wreck for 6 months and reverse everything that they did, screw their metabolism up and everything worse than it was, and they go through this cycle of 30 days on, 4 months off, 30 days on, 4 months off, and then they look back on the year and they're like, why the hell am I 15 pounds heavier than I started? And I really want to encourage people, just that the key is get up as fast as you can once you stumble, because it's okay to stumble. We're all going to do it. Nobody's perfect. And really, if you can look back on the year and have averaged a B+ or an A-, you're going to be so much further ahead than you would if you do the perfection dumpster fire model. it just doesn't work, and it just screws you up more than it helps you. And so I really encourage people just to forget all of these ridiculous crash diets and all these ways of eating. Eat real food. Eat as much of it as you like, move your body, and be consistent with it. And when you do slip up, because we will, we're not perfect, and we live in a society of social events and things like that, reward yourself. It's okay, and just get back up on it the next day and keep moving your body and eating good food.
I completely agree with you. And food's become a reward system, especially in the fitness industry, where people think, oh, I've done really well this week or this month, so I'm going to go reward myself. And then it becomes a slippery slope of addiction and binge and purge style eating. And it's so prominent that it's almost, the industry just needs a huge paradigm shift away from, I honestly try to dissuade people from competing in events like bodybuilding and fitness who aren't really, really strong mentally, because it always ends up being this inevitable binge and purge mentality where I'm gonna train really hard and I'm gonna eat like crap to reward myself for this week or for this competition or whatever, and then develop such a negative paradigm around food. Whereas, like you say, man, you're just eating good quality food. You're eating to be healthy and fit all the time. You're eating to fuel your body, and you have a great healthy relationship with food. And everyone absolutely needs to hear that.
Yeah, I agree.
So looking back, man, I want to look at some other things that you did to mitigate inflammation and recovery, and IVs, and I see here with the Normatec sleeves, and you had to have been doing something. I mean, was it every day IV? Was it oxygen therapy? Was it was there supplements? Was there like a ton of caffeine involved? Like, I'm looking for the strategies, or is it just like, hey man, I'm taking my balls out of my purse today and I'm going?
Yeah, I call it I played my man card.
Yeah.
For 50 days. But everybody wants to know kind of the one thing that I did, or what's the one thing you do for recovery, and there isn't one thing. The secret to success is doing a lot of little things consistently over a long period of time, and they're called the basics. And really, it was doing a lot of little things. But nutritionally, one of my biggest supporters from day one is Young Living Essential Oils, and they're more than just an oil company. They do an entire supplement line, and we were heavy on those every single day. I think that was a big contributor to us feeling the way that we were feeling and helping my body recover. But I had my chiropractor come out every weekend, and we did laser acupuncture, scraping, manipulation, cold laser, you name it. I slept 4 hours a night in recovery boots and compression. I didn't have time for ice baths or anything, but inflammation, it was just a byproduct of eating real food, eating a ton of fruits, a ton of vegetables. We've got pictures where I'm eating trays and trays of just good food that combats all of that stuff. There was a healthy dose of caffeine. I would probably have at least two monster proteins that have caffeine in it. That was kind of kept me going, or waking me up. But it was just anything that we could do, all the little things, we did as much as we could. So it's not just one thing. I mean, we just did as much as we could then that we had time for outside of surviving.
Right. So perfect segue. Surviving. Your doctor said you were going to die. Did you do blood work pre, intra, post? And what was the final damage. How did you kind of assess damage when it all came to an end?
Yeah, I had extensive blood work done beforehand, and then we had blood tests done throughout. We did that for drug testing purposes and just to make sure that everything was okay for me. I've got five kids, and at no point in time were we going to put my life at extreme jeopardy. We had a good pulse on everything as we were going through it. My wife was monitoring everything. She knows me better than anybody. But yeah, my one of the biggest concerns was my heart rate got so low that it wasn't. Circulation became an issue. My hands and my feet became numb.
What's so low?
During the bike portion, I would sit around 105 beats, and during the marathon portion, maybe 114. And then my resting heart rate was well into the 40s. Late into the journey, I mean, they would try to draw blood for me, and we couldn't even fill up the vials because the beat wasn't pushing out enough force to fill it up, and so it became difficult to draw blood. That's when we knew that we were getting close to that.
Were you consuming a lot of sodium for that reason?
We had a mixture that we put in my drinks that did have a high sodium count, high sodium, high potassium, high magnesium. And we did some saline bags, but not a ton of them. We didn't start until day number 8. And the only reason we did those was because I got so behind with, we did it in June and July. And so the temperatures were super, super hot and really, really humid once you get through the southern states. And, once I finished at night and I'd been, sweating profusely all day, it was hard for me to recover fast enough because if I stopped moving and we were traveling at night to go to the next state, I would fall asleep. And a lot of times they would leave me food and my drinks that I was supposed to drink, and I'd wake up in the morning and I'd only taken two sips because I'd literally have fallen asleep.
Right.
And I would wake up in the morning starving because I didn't get an opportunity to eat the food I was supposed to eat because the crew was doing all of the work that they needed to do to get us to the next state. And a lot of times the motorhome with the kids and stuff left before I did because I was finishing late at the night and the motorhome traveled much slower.
So I'm flipping through your book here, man. There's tons of pictures of all the meals you're eating, all the people that came along the journey. And I think that may be the most compelling part of the journey for all the listeners is to go out and actually get this book and look at all the people that came, selflessly gave their time and wanted to be part of your journey. Can you talk a little bit about some of the unique people that came and met you and cheered you on?
Yeah, that was one of the most surprising and unique and humbling aspects of it was the amount of people that eventually ended up rallying around us and showing up in every single state, and the emails that we still get today of the people that we impacted and the changes that they've made. And I think that it's one of the things I like best about the book, and I could write a second book on all the other people, but I love the stories that went along with the journey and the impact that we were able to have. It's just, I call it Iron Man kind, and it just has reinstilled my belief in kind of people rallying around a cause. Because in the news you hear all of the negativity and all the things, and you start to think that all of humanity is a pile of poop. But the reality is there's so many really good, cool people out there, and they came out, and the support that people gave us, we really became dependent out of necessity on these groups of people that we called them ambassadors, and they would literally volunteer, and they would put together the entire day for us. And our days became so chaotic, and minute to minute, we didn't have time to shop. And people would bring us food and have activities for the kids and send us with food. And people caught wind that our generator and our fridges had broken in our motorhome, and so we didn't have any way to store food. And so they would – it was just unbelievable. People really came out and supported, and we really wouldn't have been able to accomplish this without that massive nationwide team effort.
With all the food you're eating, did you get sick? Like, there's one pic in here where you're sick in Hawaii after the marathon. I'm guessing you're consuming all this food while you're doing all this physical exercise. How'd you feel?
Yeah, so it was unique. You don't think of a lot of the different elements that go into training and preparing for this. And one of those things I had to do was train my body how to eat food while moving.
Yep.
And so it was part of my training regime that I would consume while doing these 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-hour training days. And I got very, very good at that. The only reason I got sick in Hawaii was heat exhaustion. The first time that my body races in humidity and heat, it kind of freaks out a little bit, but then it's fine. And so that was really the first exposure. Hawaii was super hot that day. I mean, we're talking June in Hawaii, humidity, and my body's just getting adapted to doing this. It's the beginning of the journey. And so, yeah, I threw up violently at the end of that one, but that was the only real time. And that was another complete miracle on this journey that I didn't have. I mean, everybody on the crew got sick. I mean, throwing up, and I mean, we're in close proximity in the motorhome. Something was going to go wrong, and I never got sick, which is completely mind-blowing. And again, I give a lot of the credit to the Young Living product line, but it was amazing, because when you're doing an Ironman, your body is so susceptible to, your immune system is just attacked and shut down, and you really open yourself up to anything that's out there. And the fact that I didn't get sick again goes to show the power of the mind. And when you make a decision, have enough belief and conviction, and go all in, it overcomes a lot of the obstacles that would normally be just an excuse or a reason to not continue to do what you're doing.
What was your first meal when you were done? So there's actually a picture here, but I want you to
yeah with my buddy Garen. Yeah. The first meal was at the finish line that I had at the actual event site was a Costa Vida, two chicken enchiladas from a restaurant.
Was that your request? Was it your craving, or you just kind of had what was the first thing you saw?
No, that was a request, what I was craving. It is one of my favorite places to eat here locally. We did finish in Utah, and a lot of my training was that food. And so it was kind of, you know, that emotional connection to being home, to having that. And so that was one of the first things that I had once I finished. But then a couple days later, once I woke up, my best friend Garen, he loves to cook and do barbecues. And so that plate that you see was kind of my final finish meal. It had, you know, steak and chicken and some shrimp and grilled asparagus and some real good food.
How many days of recovery did it take after this thing was done before you felt like a normal human being again?
You're assuming today I feel like a normal human being. I still deal with a few things. I don't have my athletic self back. It's been an interesting 2 years.
Really?
Recovery and building the speaking portion of what we're doing and the coaching side of things. And
explain that to me, James. What do you mean you don't have your athletic side back?
Well, we did a ton. You know, you start to go long and do these endurance feats, it's really damaging on the body, and your cortisol levels are through the roof, and you know, it really messes with your hormones. And for me, I decided this year that I'm going to take the next couple years and really get back to power, speed, explosiveness, and get that athlete back. I've gone too far away from it. And I really enjoyed that aspect to it. So I'm, you know, everybody, you know, they get into, or they see triathlon and they're like, I have to do an Ironman. And there's so much fun and difficulty and whatnot in the short distance racing of it. I mean, you look at the Olympics, that is the Olympic distance. I mean, that there's got to be something said about the difficulty and challenge going all out for 2 hours. I mean, you've got to pin it for, you know, an hour to 2 hours. I mean, that's a different kind of racing, and I've really missed that aspect of it. I've done enough long enduring and figuring it out. I'm looking to go back to kind of the grassroots and where I began, and I'm really excited next year to kind of dial it back in and get some explosiveness back in and get back to being fast.
So you have seen some lasting detrimental hormonal effects.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We're still working with that, and we're trying to get those changes with, you know, good diet and clean food and back in the gym and things like that.
Fascinating, man. That's an interesting road. Have you done any inquiries into, like, telomeres? Are you familiar with telomeres?
I don't know what that is.
So telomere is the end of a DNA strand that is now correlated with the length of your life and longevity. And I'd be very curious to see, and it's something you can change. You can lengthen or you can shorten according to nutrition and stuff. And that would be something you may want to look into, man. It's like a definitive way to quantify, hey, am I actually doing something to obviously improve quality of life, but improve quantity of life as well. And telomeres is the only scientific definitive way to actually determine, you know, they say you can determine how long you're going to live.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I'm going to look into that for sure. I've had some genetic testing done. It was interesting. They wanted to know what was different about me genetically that made it capable
big
for me.
Balls.
Yeah, that's all it came down to. Yeah. You know, because there wasn't anything genetically special about me. I joke from stage and I say I'm, you know, I got the results back and they said I was white Canadian. but really, they couldn't measure, you know, my mind. They couldn't measure my heart. They couldn't, you know, they couldn't measure passion and desire and commitment and all of those things. And so it was, it'd be interesting to take that test that you're talking about and see what the damage is now. And then as I make key changes and get back to, you know, a different style of racing, what that does to those markers.
Sure, definitely something to look into. So, James, one of the things that I love about this interview with you is everything you said so far has been we. You've never once said I. Who is we? And, you know, I'd like to hear who your support team is.
Yeah, it starts with my wife, Sunny. You know, even this morning we went on a two-hour ride together. But that's the core of the team. Nothing gets done, you know, without her support and obviously all the hard work and everything that she does. And then our core team on the 50th, I had two wingmen with me full time, Casey and Aaron.
They did the whole 50 with you?
Yeah, they were the support group. So they made sure that I had everything that I needed during the day. And then, man, their incredible job was to also drive me through the night. Mm-hmm. And so for seven consecutive weeks, my wife and these two guys, they really didn't have a day and a night distinction. They were always on the go, always problem solving, always looking a week ahead. And it was just unbelievable. And that's why, without, you know, any hesitation, it's definitely we. There's no 50-50-50 without my wife and these two other guys. It just doesn't happen. It's not possible.
Amazing. So I know you got five kids, and a lot of my listeners are dads, are guys who are trying to live this balance, if you could call it balance. And I always, you know, say that's the irony of life. There's no such thing, but trying to live this balance between being an amazing athlete, looking and feeling awesome, and still having time, energy, and focus for your children and your family. What are the things that you maybe attach to as a dad to make sure that you always stay grounded and always become a great dad while still, you know, balancing training and family life?
Yeah, you know, this is a question that comes up a lot. And you know, this is where my wife and I struggle with kind of mindset of individuals that are either making excuses or whatnot, because everybody always says, I don't have time for X, Y, or Z. It takes away from X, Y, or Z. And yeah, the reality is you do have to sacrifice some things in order to accomplish other things. But the reality is you have enough time in your day for whatever you make time for. Mm-hmm. And whatever you prioritize and however you want to put that on your list. And you have to sacrifice one thing or another to achieve one thing or another. Well, my wife and I have this conversation all the time of individuals that are either making excuses, but you truly do have enough time in a day for what you make time for. And it's just a matter of being organized and attacking things in an appropriate time. If you want to sleep more, you're going to sacrifice something in order to get that sleep done. If you want to spend more time with your family, you're going to sacrifice something over here. And different times on your journey, you're going to, that sacrifice and task list is going to shift depending on where your priorities are. I mean, I had to almost be selfish, and I don't like the word selfish, but I almost had to go all in and kind of take a moment for 50 days with the big picture of knowing if we make it through this, I'm going to have more family time. Mm-hmm. And so during that phase, I was more sacrificing family time to do the physical side of things. But now it's flipped because now I have more family time because of what we did. And so there's different periods that everybody will go through, and the sacrifice is going to be different, and your time allotment is going to be different depending on the phase. It's a but you just have to be careful that you come back to a grounded state out of those moments, because if you get carried away and you go into that state where you're always abandoning your family, abandon, and there's no bigger picture or finish line or transition away from that, that's when you get into trouble. And you know, with our coaching philosophy, we're 80% recovery and 20% hammer down. And with life, I like to shift that to where you have, you know, and maybe it's not 80-20, maybe it's 60-40, but you know, you put the family priority first and then hammer down on the work. And so you've got to have that balance between family, fun, and play. And once you balance those out consistently, that's when things are going to, you know, everybody's got to find their own rhythm, but it absolutely is possible. I mean, I mean everybody's busy, but I know my wife and I are extremely busy, and we manage to do a lot of family time, and we make that a priority. And you truly have time for what you make time for.
Do your kids do any of the racing with you, or any of the running, the cycling, the swimming, or do you have any family rituals that allow you guys to kind of bond on a regular basis?
You know, we do a lot of family stuff. I mean, just last night we were in the backyard for 20-30 minutes. My wife was throwing ball with my youngest son, and then we kind of all gathered around and we started playing volleyball for 20 minutes. And so we just have to unplug for a second sometimes. And my wife does a good job of pulling me away from the computer and helping me realize that the family's there. We don't have a steady routine, but you know, we always make time or opportunities. I mean, last week we were on the lake boating. Sundays are actually a day where I try not to work, but I find myself doing it. But Sunday is a day where we don't do any workouts. We don't work out. We go to church, and then we will typically play a game with the family or something. So if there is a tradition or a routine, it'd be Sundays for sure. I never work out on Sundays. I only race on Sundays.
Awesome, man. James, it's been a complete honor and a pleasure. If you have any sponsors you'd like to give a shout out to, because I'm looking through your book here and I see you've got, like, I think anyone who's willing to support you on this journey deserves a shout out. And not that I like to use this for shameless plugs of anything, but if there's any people or businesses you'd like to give shout outs to, I think this is a great time, because you're doing something awesome, man. And, you know, I definitely want to support anything you're involved with.
Yeah, for sure. Just a quick rundown of the kind of the companies that have been with me from the beginning and supported me: Young Living Essential Oils for all my nutritionals, Ultra Running Shoes, they've been with me since day one, they're unbelievable, Rudy Helmets and Glasses, totally love them, Jaybird Wireless Headphones, spectacular, Maverick, it's a gas station line that actually has real food, and Fazari Bikes, Blue 70 Wetsuits and Swim Gear, I'm probably forgetting somebody, but yeah, those are the core ones that I absolutely love and live by. Garmin, they take care of me too.
So James, a lot of great
sponsors.
What advice would you have for someone like myself who's wanting to do their first Ironman?
Yeah.
Besides lose 80 pounds, I know that one.
Yeah.
So it's the second one.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, Ironman is a very difficult journey and that has a steep learning curve. We touched on that earlier in the call. And I think one of the biggest things that people struggle with is knowing if they're doing enough or not enough, or the right intensity, not enough intensity. And I don't say this because I'm a coach, but I would get guidance or enlist somebody that you trust to help take away some of those pitfalls that you're inevitably going to do. And if somebody can kind of lay the path out for you that you trust, then you know that you can just go out and do the work and that you're doing the right steps, because the hardest part about doing an Ironman is the training leading up to the Ironman. The Ironman should be a victory lap, a celebration. And if you've done all the things right leading up to that point, it should be and will be. And so my biggest advice to you is do the right things leading up to it. Don't rush the process. Give it the time that it respects in order to do this, so that it'll put you in position. I like to say that you only have one chance to do your first Ironman. And so do it right. It's already expensive, so just invest a little bit more and enlist someone that knows what they're doing to ensure that you have a good first experience.
And how long should someone be training for an Ironman? Like, how long do you train for? Obviously you're at a different level now. You probably never stop training, but if someone said you're their first Ironman, how long would you recommend to prepare?
I like to work with my athletes for about a year, and that obviously depends on where they are in their journey. I like to do 6 months worth of prep and strength and groundwork, and then really get into more specifics for the event about 6 months out. And if somebody does that and gives us that amount of time to work together, I've never had them not succeed and have a good day.
So you're working with people one-on-one now, or do you have coaches that work under you, or what's the system?
So both. We have online coaching platform, and then we also have a one-on-one group. And so we have four coaches that are working full-time with these athletes. And so it really depends on the needs of the athlete, how much individual one-on-one time they need, or someone that just needs structure and a little bit of encouragement, depending on what kind of program you pick.
Cool, man. That's fascinating. Fantastic. James, I appreciate your time, man. Everyone can find James at ironcowboy.co.
Pick up C-O-M.
Oh, is it C-O-M?
Yeah, the C-O is the older site. The new site is ironcowboy.com.
Okay, cool, man. So ironcowboy.com. Is the coaching there as well?
All the links can be from ironcowboy.com, but if they want to go directly to the coaching, teamironcowboy.com. And then my social media handles on Instagram, it's ironcowboyjames, and on Facebook, it's /ironcowboy. I post a lot of stuff on there, a lot of fun. But my website, you know, you can get coaching, you can get any of the merchandise or the books, and then you can also, anybody that's interested in having me come out and tell my story from stage and kind of change your mindset. I talk around the world. I'm booked right now in 20 countries. I leave on Friday for India. So a lot of fun experiences. But if anybody that does want to hear more about the story, you can also get in contact with us through the website, ironcowboy.com.
Thanks so much, James, man. I appreciate having you on, and have a great day. Keep doing awesome things.
Hey, man. Thanks, Ben.
Join us on BenPokulski.com to learn the cutting-edge techniques to take control of your body, your brain, and create your greatest life.